You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she too can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Before we get started here, I want to tell you about some sponsors. Sponsors are what make this show possible, and here they are. Here's one, Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, and online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter the offer code LONGFORM at checkout. You'll get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful. This week's show is also brought to you by Aspiration. At Aspiration, their investment strategies are built for the middle class. Signing up takes as little as $500 in just 5 minutes of your time. You can sign up and find out more at aspiration.com/longform. I should tell you, though, past performance is not indicative of future returns. There is no guarantee that any investment product will achieve its objectives, generate profits, or avoid losses. Investing involves risk, and alternative investments may not be suitable for everyone. So before investing, consider your investment objectives. Okay, here's the show.
Hello and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. I'm joined by Max Linsky, my co-host from Longform.
Hey, Evan.
Hey, no Aaron.
Aaron's out. Aaron's wandering the country.
He will be back. Someday. We can do this without him. We've proven it before.
It's true. I have a question for you.
Yes.
So, moral question, ethical question. At what age do you stop letting children win?
You mean in games and things?
Yeah. Like, I recently beat a teenager at a video game. I'm very conflicted about it. Like, I'm not talking about my son is very young.
He shouldn't be playing video games.
He can't win anything, so.
I'm going to turn that question around and say the thing that you should be thinking about is not when you should stop beating a teenager at video games. The question you should be asking yourself is, why are you so good at video games?
It has nothing to do with the fact that we were playing the video game that this room we're sitting in right now is built to play
well,
in. That was a good sentence.
Let me tell you this. My grandfather used to play me in chess when I was a child. And he played me in chess. Little kid, he taught me to play chess. He beat me every single time. And then when I was, I think, 13 or 14, I beat him. And then he never played me again.
That was it?
Yep.
Was that like the lesson, or he was like too prideful a man to ever lose?
I don't know.
Okay, so all right, I should just keep winning until I can't win anymore.
That's my advice.
Another thing I've been thinking about, Evan, in addition to my guilt over beating this young man, is the person that you interviewed this week.
Yes, I interviewed George Qureshi, who is the editor and co-founder of Howler magazine, which is a soccer magazine. I happen to be a person who follows the sport of soccer myself. It's a really interesting outfit. They do great work. They're trying to appeal to a particular set of people, American soccer fans, and it's primarily a print publication, which I just wanted to talk to him about that mix of things, what it takes to run something like that, and it was just fun. He's a fun person to talk to.
He is. He's like a truly like wonderful guy. I spent some time with him. He was on a panel that I moderated in Austin, and he was great. Like, I feel like those panels, often people are like kind of bullshitting and self-promotional, and it was like it was a panel about like how you do this, how you run a small magazine with not a massive budget, and he was super honest about it. Like, this is how it is. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's great. Like, you feel great when you put an issue out. I'm not trying to copy your whole interview, but he's just a great guy.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in this interview.
What else is in this intro? What's left in this intro?
Well, we got sponsors, and if you want to put the word out about something, something that's important to you, you might want to share with all your friends and people in your email contacts, you would probably create a tiny letter.
Say.
Everyone's doing it. It's easy to do. It's simple. It's powerful. It's from the people at MailChimp. We thank them for their sponsorship.
And here's Evan with George.
George, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
I don't actually know how to pronounce your last name.
Qureshi.
Qureshi.
Although I don't think that's right. In Pakistan, I don't think it's Qureshi.
Are you Pakistani?
My dad is half Pakistani, half Persian. Grew up in England.
Where did you grow up?
Tampa, Florida. Hmm. He came over to the U.S. for college. He played soccer in college and was drafted. Number one draft of the 1975 NASL college draft. And
he was?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And did he play for the Tampa Bay Rowdies?
Yeah.
God, I watched that stuff when I was a kid.
Totally.
The Atlanta Chiefs. I grew up in Atlanta.
Okay.
Atlanta Chiefs were my team. They had a goalkeeper named Graham Tutt, who was my soccer coach also on the side. Because I guess they didn't pay enough.
That's what they, my dad did that to, like, he coached every child in Tampa Bay at some point.
Wow.
70s England was not kind to, like, a guy who was, like, has dark brown skin and, you know, parents from Pakistan and whatnot. So he played soccer all the time,
like,
four or five teams at a time. You know, age groups up, you know, his own, you know, whatever. He was always playing, and that was how he got out.
When you were a kid, was he still playing, or was he finished playing?
No, he had finished. I was born in 1982. I think he retired right around then. He coached me for a little while, and then he was a little intense, just because, you know, he had pretty high standards, I guess. But a lot of his teammates had kids, and I played with them, and so one of their dads took over, and... but he was always really nice. Every year he would sit me down and say, you don't have to play if you don't want to, which was nice. I always wanted to play, but I appreciated it later when I was an adult or, you know, in high school, and I decided I actually didn't want to play.
Oh, so you quit playing soccer in high school?
I played with some really good players. We were always really strong. Like, my high school team won the national championship my senior year, but I had quit early on that year because I... like, we went away for a vacation, and then I came back and I lost my starting position. I was like, you know what, I've worked... so hard to do this and then to get here, and then I was so mad and I was like, you know, I don't need to do this, like, I've been doing this my whole life. And I was about to get into college, but I wasn't using soccer to get into college. I wasn't trying to get a scholarship
in college. Yeah.
And I was like, screw it, I don't want to do this. But then they went and won the national championship, so whatever.
But your dad was okay with that?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, he, the whole point for him was so that I wouldn't have to feel like I had to play soccer, as crazy as that sounds, in order to make a living or be who I wanted to be.
Oh, wow. Is he still around?
Yeah. He actually just took a job as the GM and president of the Tampa Bay Rowdies this year.
Well, this actually is a good place to start. So people might be wondering why we're just talking about soccer the whole time, but if they don't know who you are, because you run a soccer magazine that you also co-founded called Howler. You should probably say why it's called Howler, because people who aren't soccer fans might not even know that.
A Howler is a... like a terrible mistake. Like, if the ball goes through the goalkeeper's legs or a striker misses from, you know, yards away, that's a howler. And they use it in England. It's an English term. And so we're self-consciously very much an American soccer magazine, but we like the sense of humor that the English bring to it. And when we started it, and hopefully it's changing a little bit, I think it is, Americans were really sort of protective and didn't have a ton of irony. You know, or
it could be very... gung-ho as fans and kind of like without the kind of like deep history and sense of humor about themselves.
And for years I think that was a little bit justified because soccer kept coming and then going away and coming and going away, and so, you know, criticism of soccer seemed almost like an existential threat, I guess, to the mm-hmm. sport here. But we felt when we founded the magazine that we were in a place where it was strong and we could laugh at ourselves and have fun with it, and so that's why we called it Howler. I also think it's got a great, you know, a howler is like a big yell, right? So
yeah, it's a nice name for a magazine. Yeah, for sure. So you played some soccer. Obviously, you have like soccer in your life, grew up around it or with it. Tell me how you guys ended up starting the magazine.
I was working in New York as an editor. I was an assistant editor at HarperCollins, mm-hmm. working for a guy named David Hershey, who was a big soccer fan himself.
Mm-hmm.
I had worked at a couple magazines before that, both went away.
Which magazines were those?
National Geographic Adventure and Condé Nast Portfolio.
Oh, yeah, right.
So I was sort of looking at my life and thinking, I really love what I do. I love the editing. I love working with writers. I love it. But I don't like working on books that I don't like, or, you know, doing what other people tell me to do.
Yeah.
I guess. So I called my friend Mark Kirby. He interviewed me for my internship at National Geographic Adventure when I was in college. I was a senior in college, and then he offered it to me, and I deferred, I guess. I went abroad for a year, and I was traveling, and I decided I wanted to come home and start working, and because I had saved some money when I was teaching English abroad.
Uh-huh.
And I called him, and I was like, hey, I want to do that internship now. And he's like, okay, but I don't work there anymore. He had moved on to GQ. So I came back. It all worked out. I took the internship. I worked there.
Wait, at GQ or at National Geographic?
At Adventure.
Oh, okay.
But he and I stayed in touch. We realized we were both soccer fans, and we played soccer together sometimes in, you know, the city leagues here. And I had seen a friend of mine start a small magazine, mm-hmm. called Kill Screen, my friend Jamin Warren. So I saw him do that.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, man, if there's an audience for a video game magazine, we can definitely build one for a soccer magazine. And Mark had recently left GQ, and I had actually posed this to him when he was still there, and he was like, I can't do that. Just don't have time. But then he left and sort of left publishing, and he wanted to dabble a little bit.
Yeah.
And so he said, yeah, let's do it. And so then that's what started.
What is sort of the first step in starting a magazine like that? I mean, one of the things that I think people who know about Howler find interesting is the print component, that it is, it's a print magazine. There's an online aspect to it, but it's unlike many things, including like what I do. It's not in this vein of like, now we'll try to make a magazine work online. Now we'll try to, it's like actually more traditional in a real sense. And so I'm curious how you came to decide like what form it would take once you wanted to start it.
We sort of came to that decision pretty early because we figured if we gave people like a physical product that they would give us money, and we couldn't do it without money.
It's very old fashioned.
I don't know. And it was also based on a couple of calculations about who our audience would be. And we figured American soccer fans have been sort of a little bit ignored by mainstream sports press.
For sure.
A lot of the design and sort of the things that you can buy or own or show off if you're a soccer fan aren't all that well designed. They don't look great. And yet the audience is pretty upscale. Like it's people who are well educated, who appreciate nice things, who have some disposable income. I mean, I'm speaking pretty broadly here.
Yeah.
And there are a bunch of different audiences.
Yeah,
there's like
sort of like
here,
the bougie version of the US soccer fan, and then there's also like the immigrant version of the soccer fan.
Exactly.
Who's actually like following teams from where they came from.
But you know, if you walk around Brooklyn on a Saturday morning and walk past like Floyd or Woodwork and see those people coming out of the bars wearing their Arsenal jerseys, that's who I'm talking about.
Yeah, they're in the first group there.
And so what happened was, I think Howler became like almost like a totem of their fanhood. Like it was something they could show off that felt like it hit the same things they liked about other things in their lives that they showed off. At the time, I wanted to make a really beautiful, big sports magazine, a soccer magazine. Illustration has always been a big part of the mag and photography, and I think that's fun.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And then logistically, did you go out and fundraise for it? Did you say, like, we'll put our own money into it to start with, or how did you get off the ground?
We were a Kickstarter campaign.
Oh, right.
And we set a goal of $50,000.
Uh-huh.
And Jamin, when he started Killscreen, I think he set a goal of $5,000. This was a couple years before us, and raised like six something. And I think he looked back and was like, man, I wish Kickstarter had been bigger when I did, you know.
Yeah, I guess that was before the era of like things really blowing up.
Yeah.
Really got.
So we raised $69,001 and that paid for the first issue. And I call it subsistence magazine making because every issue pays for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
But the margins are pretty slim on a print magazine, as you can imagine. I mean, after you get to shipping and we pay for the, you know, the content, the art, the writing, the printing is massively expensive. The mag weighs over a pound, so
yeah.
Like shipping is expensive. It's also like it's 10 inches by 12 inches, which is the same format as ESPN, the magazine, if you're familiar with that. But what we learned was that actually at that size, the printer was having to use more signatures of more sheets of paper. They couldn't get as many sheets off of one big sheet as they could have if we were like slightly smaller. And so we were just paying more in terms of, you know, for the paper costs, for the shipping than I don't know. If someone had sort of drawn up a business plan and been like, okay, here's how you maximize profits on a print magazine, we probably would have done things a little differently. But as we sort of led with the aesthetics and like thought, okay, this is what we want to make, and now let's figure out how to pay for it. And we've been able to do it, but you run into like little difficulties and learn things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to pause things quickly, tell you a little bit about our sponsors this week. First up is Squarespace, the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store. If you've ever tried to build a website yourself, you know it's a huge pain. Here's my guess. You haven't even tried to build a website. At least if you're anything like me, you haven't tried to build a website. I can't tell you how many times I've had an idea and I was like, that'll be great. And then I've started to think about building the website and been like, I'll just do that tomorrow. Countless ideas that have never come to fruition just because I didn't want to deal with building a site. But with Squarespace, you don't have to dread that part. They make it super easy. Everything is beautiful and powerful and works on every device. All you have to do is pick a look that works for you and get going on your idea. If you hit any snags, you won't. But if you do, they've got fantastic 24/7 support. It's all just $8 a month. Plus, you get a free domain name if you sign up for a year. Start a free trial right now, squarespace.com. No credit card required. When you do decide to sign up, make sure to use the offer code LONGFORM at checkout. You'll get 10% off. Remember, that's not just a way to save some money. You're also supporting the show, which is exactly what Squarespace has been doing for years now. Thanks, Squarespace. Also sponsoring the show this week, The Great Courses. For 25 years, The Great Courses has been delivering lectures from top professors and experts for the pure pleasure of learning. They've got over 500 series on tons of topics, including history, science, literature, philosophy, and more, and everything is available in any format you could want: digital downloads, streaming, even CDs and DVDs, so you can learn on your own time. A few weeks ago, I told you about a course they offer, Writing Creative Nonfiction, which is a great choice if you're looking to start doing the kind of work we talk about every week on this show. But if you're just looking to improve your writing generally, another course you could try is Analysis and Critique: How to Engage and Write About Anything. It's taught by Professor Dorsey Armstrong of Purdue University, and it gives you just all these basic fundamentals for good writing. So here's what you should do. If you're interested in that or any of the other courses at The Great Courses, check out thegreatcourses.com/longform. That's thegreatcourses.com/longform. If you go there, you get up to 80% off How to Engage and Write About Anything and 8 of their other bestsellers. Thanks very much to them for sponsoring the show. And let's get back to George and Evan.
I'm just really interested in the business aspects of it in terms of, like, when you were pulling people in to be involved in it, you know, whether design or, like, obviously, I don't know how much you already knew about, like, finding a printer and, you know, figuring out how it's going to get printed and shipped. When you say the original $60,000+, were you like, I'll pay you a couple grand? Or how did you, or did you say, like, this, come join me in my effort, like, volunteer at first and then later, like, there'll be jobs for everyone?
That was probably the scariest part, like, thinking, okay. And there was a team of us. It wasn't just me. And, you know, we had two designers. It was Mark and myself, and then two designers. And, you know, they shouldered some of that, and they finding the printer and dealing with that. I was very worried about the money. I'd never started a business before. I had never produced a physical thing before. Like, you know, had somebody make something and then send it to me. And budgeting out for stories and for art was really scary because you're like, well, I get one shot. And then if I promise too much money, you can't renegotiate. Like, you don't, you know, and you're already like asking people to do stuff for, you know, way below what they normally get for what they do. You know, that was part of the premise of Howler. We thought, okay, we worked at big magazines, so we want to make a magazine that looks like that and feels like that. But we don't have any of the resources of like a Condé Nast or whatever. And so, you know, we sort of cobbled it together, but the people who worked on it were all really good. And so I think in the end it worked out and we figured out how to keep that model going.
And when you say you go sort of issue to issue in terms of sustainable, like, what did you call it? Subsistence magazine making. It's reader funded primarily, or is it advertising funded primarily?
It's primarily reader funded.
Yeah.
Each issue is $15. Each subscription is $50. We have around 2,500 subscribers. You know, our print run is around, this last issue was 10,000. The most we've done is 14 for the World Cup issue because we got a big order from Barnes & Noble. Any advertising we get is basically based on a relationship where the person writing the check for a big brand or whoever likes what we do and sort of believes in it. You know, there's no argument on a spreadsheet for, hey, let's advertise in Howler. You know what I mean?
I mean, I don't know that much about print advertising. I mean, I know a little bit about print advertising, but I would think that they're in the same way that these sort of like the types of fans who might subscribe to it also might occupy some like income level that like a certain advertiser could be like, I could sell jerseys to these people.
That's an argument that we make.
Yeah.
But it's not one that media buyers or brands are used to hearing. I mean, most print advertising is bought through third party houses that do this, and it's not really worth the time of a big like brand manager, advertising guy at a huge company to spend their time like giving us tens of thousands of dollars, whatever. Like they're looking at campaigns that are in the millions, and I don't know. We have to hit some sort of personal interest with them in order for them to really buy in and want to work with us.
I mean, it seems like it's plausible that actually being reader supported is a sort of more secure place to be.
I love it
anyways.
Yeah, I love it because our readers love us, I think. I mean, when we mess up a lot, they forgive us. Like we had a shipping disaster that, you know, when we used to ship through Amazon. You build a relationship with people initially because they like the product, but then because I think they, I think maybe this is me imposing like some narrative on this, but because they see us working hard to provide something that they didn't have before that they really like. And so the money that comes from readers is bite sizes compared to, you know, a check we might get from, you know, once in a while from an advertiser. That means so much more because it's like, okay, you are actually, you're benefiting from this in a real way. I don't make a lot of money. And when I give my money to something like that, I'm thinking, well, I really want what you're making.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good feeling, I think, from on the other side.
Yeah.
When someone says that to me.
And also feel like the sense that there's actually like human beings on the other end of the thing makes a big difference. Like whenever you're buying something, subscribing to something that feels like it's coming from a giant building on Fifth Avenue or whatever, you just kind of like, my subscription's late, I'm really angry, cancel my subscription or whatever. But when you're dealing with like, I know about the people who founded this. Like, I know what they're trying to do and I support it. Like, that's a whole different
Well, we get those
ballpark.
Tweets too.
Yeah.
But then the difference is that I respond to them and they're like, oh, okay, yeah, no, I love what you guys do. Don't worry about it. Like, you know, hopefully one day we'll become so big that I cannot respond to every complaint. But at this stage, I find that I have to because it really builds, you know, we're going to lose a certain number of people every issue. That's fine. That's just the business. But, there are ways we can keep people around and not just through the content or whatever the products, through being nice to them and responding to them when they have a problem. We have a guy in Canada who, for some reason, the USPS just does not get his issue to him for like a month after we send it out. And every time, and he emails us and we're just like, if I could control the USPS, I would change so many things. I would like, whatever, I would change this. But he still subscribes and he gets it.
So when you set out to create the magazine, mm-hmm. you know, you would think that, okay, you've decided it's going to be a soccer magazine for sort of like the American soccer fan in different ways. You've got a topic that you're around. But actually, like, the types of stories that are possible within that, given how big soccer is in the rest of the world, are enormous. And I'm curious how you conceive, like, what types of stories you guys do, particularly the long-form stuff. Like, you do it, like, packages that you would expect around the World Cup or other things. But, like, what goes into deciding like what is a Howler feature, the longer features?
Well, I wouldn't conflate our audience with the topics that we cover
mm.
because the nice thing about, you know, soccer fans in America is that their interests are kind of infinite. Like mm-hmm. there's a huge world of soccer stories and we don't live in a country that has such a strong tradition of club or even international soccer that people sort of don't look beyond it. They're interested in soccer anywhere. And so that gives us a huge amount of room where we can bring in stories that I think if we were talking to an audience that was sort of more focused on what's happening, you know, in their country or with their league, we wouldn't be able to publish the stories we do. So we always try to hit a few things that are going to be of interest to our fans. So, you know, fans of American soccer. So, you know, we talk about American soccer players. We're shooting Mix Diskerud later this afternoon, right?
And the man of the flowing hair.
Totally. We've got him at a hair salon, which is going to be fun. We service our readers with that stuff, but then we also bring stories, I think, that I'm just personally interested in. Like, you know, and soccer sort of serves those up constantly. You know, there's no shortage of weird stories to tell.
Yeah, and I'm amazed for a small magazine how much international reporting you have. I mean, it makes sense given the topic, but how do you wrangle these stories? I mean, you got stories from people going to Bolivia, people in Brazil, people in Eastern Europe. You know, these stories are coming from everywhere. Do you find people who are already located there? Are you paying their expenses? Like, how does it work?
Yeah, there's sort of it's a hodgepodge. We have a really good network of writers who travel for other stories and for, you know, to, you know, we piggyback mm-hmm. on a lot of, Luke O'Brien has written a bunch for us. And he was going to Brazil for Slate anyway. And I said, okay, well, when you go to Manaus, just write some crazy gonzo story about Manaus. I had heard some comment on Twitter from a guy who knows Brazil pretty well that Manaus was like the Bangkok of South America, like the seediest kind of place. And so, and Luke wrote a story during the 2006 World Cup where he went to a very high price brothel.
Yeah, I remember that was for Slate. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And I loved it. And I thought, okay, just go to Manaus and just try to get in trouble or do whatever. And we had an intern who was down there as well. And so
who features in the story?
Yeah, that became part of the story. And it turns out they Luke was had all these plans for him, but then he found out that they went to the same small school, like Quaker school. And he was like, I can't put this kid in danger. Robert, who wrote the piece that you're talking about in Bolivia.
Yeah.
And Bolivia sort of features in it, but it's not the main part. But he just, he went down there because he was interested in this guy he was profiling, and it turned out to be a big story for us that Longform published.
So the premise of the story is they want to launch a soccer team in Miami. That's, they want to get into the MLS.
Yeah, they being David Beckham, Simon Fuller, who's the creator of American Idol, and this guy named Marcelo Claure, who we didn't really know much about, but is, you know, apparently an independently wealthy, like, billionaire from Bolivia who lives in Miami or used to live in Miami and is now the CEO of Sprint. And so it's this sort of trifecta of really rich dudes who want to start a soccer team in Miami. And Robert Andrew Powell, who wrote the story and has written, I think, some of our best pieces.
You wrote a great book about soccer, too.
Oh, so yeah. Good. He went to live in Ciudad Juarez during, like, the height of when that city was like the most dangerous city in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah.
But he wrote the book about the soccer team. And so it was a great way to look at the city. You know, as a citizen of Miami, he lives in Miami now and has for a long time, you know, and a soccer fan, and really good writer. He was interested in this guy.
The third guy, the Bolivian guy.
The third guy. Well, yeah, I mean, he was interested in the whole thing, but it just turns out that this, like, ironically, this like super wealthy CEO of a Fortune 100 company was also the easiest to get to.
Right. Of the three.
Yes.
Yeah. You're not getting to David Beckham.
No.
Most likely.
No. He's off promoting his whiskey and his, you know, whatever, clothing lines and hair products and I don't even know what. So he decided to look into this guy, and he sort of, you know, Robert's a funny guy. He writes for us because he likes us, not because it makes any business sense for him, even though we pay him better than I'm able to pay a lot of writers, because I really, really value what he brings to the mag, and I think he deserves it. So he sort of went off. He was like, look, I'm gonna look into this guy. And I was like, great, do whatever you want, you know, he's that kind of writer for us. And so he flew to Bolivia. He bought the ticket himself. We're just paying him back. This was last summer. And he's like, and the next thing I know, I get a text message from him, and he's sent me a selfie of himself on the field at a Copa Libertadores semifinal match of the team that he's going to report on. This guy Claure also owns the best team in Bolivia.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, like, you're down on the field. That's great. Wow. And he just started reporting, and then he flew to Kansas City, and you know, he ended up staying in a hotel, but I put out a call on Howler's Twitter account and said, hey, any Kansas City people who could put up a writer? And we got a bunch of responses, and and so this is sort of, you know, the undercurrent is how do we get these stories done? Like, that's how. Then he went to Kansas City, met with Claure, and took him to his first Kansas City soccer game, for sure. We think maybe his first MLS game, where we haven't seen any evidence that he's been to one before.
Which, the irony being, this is a man who says that he wants to start an MLS franchise.
Yes, and in fact, this is his second attempt at that. He was trying in the late, like 2008, 2009, to partner with FC Barcelona to bring a team to Miami. So, you know, the story became, I mean, it was about this guy. It was a profile of Claure, but it was really about, in my opinion, who are the people who want to own soccer in the US? Like, who owns it? These guys, David Beckham had a $25 million franchise fee written into his first contract with MLS. So he, you know, contrast that with, I think, New York City FC, the new team here, the fee was reported at, I think, $100 million. So he's getting a great deal. And it turned out that Beckham's group in Miami, they've been fighting to get waterfront property for a little while now. They went after, I think, 36 acres of some of the last undeveloped property down there. And the last sale of that property valued it at $100 million an acre. So these guys are going to pay a $25 million franchise fee, but we're asking the city of Miami to give them $3.6 billion in land subsidies. I mean, that's not about the soccer team.
Like, it's a business story.
Yeah, it's a grab for incredible wealth.
Yeah.
By incredibly wealthy people.
So the story was fantastic, and it really did. I mean, as someone who, like, I don't know the ins and outs of, like, even how the Major League Soccer works and how the franchises work and all that stuff, like, it really dug into that, this sort of, like, mysterious business of how is this really happening and, like, how is it coming about? And then, but then there was this, like, moment in the piece that kind of blew up when it came out, which you can describe, but...
That was extremely contentious.
Yeah.
So the background is that Robert reported the story, the Kansas City part, in October of last year. The league is a single entity. Every player contract, they're not owned by the individual teams, they're owned by the league, which keeps costs down because there's really very little competition. You know, the teams can't drive the prices of the players up, the contracts and whatever, by competing with each other. They're signed by the league and then distributed in via various mechanisms. This was back in October, but at the end of January, the latest collective bargaining agreement between the players and the league was set to expire, and those are five-year periods. And Robert quoted the owner of one of the Kansas City teams as saying that, you know, if the players were to strike, that they would fire them all and hire new ones. And for various reasons, that was a quote that they vigorously objected to.
So there were a couple things going on. One was that that's a very explosive thing to say as a someone involved in, like, labor negotiations, you mm-hmm. know, to a reporter. But then this other aspect of it kind of blew up because there was some question of, like, it was overheard in a social setting in which maybe the guy claims not to have known that it was a reporter, and then maybe claims to have never said it at all.
So we tried to be very transparent in the actual stage management that we reveal in the piece. So, you know, we added some stuff to make it very clear how these exchanges took place.
Yeah.
But basically, Marcelo Chloe brought Robert, you know, they were watching the game together. He brought him up to the Sprint box at halftime. So Robert was a guest of this guy. One of the owners of Kansas City comes into the box. The three of them are talking. Marcelo introduces Robert to this guy. His name is Cliff Illig, as a writer for Howler, reporting a story on him. Cliff apparently says something like, oh, you know, yeah, I know Howler, my son reads it, whatever. So that's clear that he understood Robert was a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
A minute or two later, the owner who actually said the quote, a guy named Rob Heineman, comes in to the box, and it's the four of them talking. And Robert is not introduced to him and doesn't introduce himself to him. He's observing the conversation. He's there to, you know, watch this. And Marcelo is asking all these questions about the business of, you know, pretty, like, if you read the piece, pretty basic questions that you would think he'd know the answers to if you're this far in the process of trying to get a team. And that's when Heineman says what he said, and then he leaves. And then Robert and Marcelo walk down, and Marcelo then says something about Major League Soccer. He likes it because it's quote-unquote communist, which is another, that's the quote that he was pushing, that he denied saying. Basically, Rob Heineman did not know that Robert was a reporter. As far as he knew, he was a complete stranger. And so we felt that Robert, by A, being invited into this press box or into the luxury box, B, by being introduced to, you know, he was introduced to this guy's business partner, and C, by being a stranger, you know, in this guy's presence in a group of four, it wasn't like he was walking by and overheard it, really cleared the burdens mm-hmm. that a reporter had.
And did you feel, were you making this decision in the context of editing the story and knowing that this was going to be a big deal, or did it surprise you when
I knew it would be a big deal
when it blew up? Yeah,
I didn't get this. I didn't get the text until January.
Uh-huh.
So the CBA expired end of January, but they really had until March 8th to strike a deal because that was the first game of the season. So sometime in February, I told Robert, hey, go to Kansas City and tell them we have this and ask them if he'd like to expand on those comments. And that was a way for us to sort of do some due diligence and, you know, try to get another quote, but also, you know, we're an industry magazine. I work with these guys pretty closely. You know, we're going to run something they don't like, but I can at least do them a courtesy and give them a heads up. I think that was a decision we made that I don't think a lot of other magazines might have made, but in that case, it felt right to me. And so we did. And then there was immediate and vigorous pushback, but we published the quote.
I mean, it seemed like there was a whole, like, journalistic ethics discussion, like Gamergate or something, you know, it's about ethics and journalism kind of thing that emerged out of it, that I just saw, like, in your Twitter feed that you responded to, like, the thousands of tweets or something.
That felt like a sideshow, honestly. I mean,
really?
Yeah. Kansas City sent us a couple of denials that we ran with the piece. Clary sent us a denial that we ran with the piece. And if you read Kansas City's second one, which is much longer, closely, they're making two arguments. One is it was unethical to run that quote because this guy didn't know he was talking to a reporter. And he didn't say it.
Those don't fit together.
No, they don't. So oftentimes when a reporter is reporting a story, they'll hear a story that someone will tell about someone else, and then they'll go to verify it, and that person who the story is being told about will say, oh, no, that didn't happen. And then you're like, okay, well, they're denying that this happened. These were quotes that were said to a reporter. So if you're denying the quote, you're actually saying that you're calling his entire credibility in question, and he heard this stuff. And so I had no question that Robert was telling the truth. I mean, he's credible. He's really good. I think his reporting was amazing on this story. If I had any doubt, or if it had been, I think, another writer, I might have had a little more doubt. But this guy, I had no problem sort of backing him and believing him.
And has there been continued fallout from it? Like the Kansas City, that clubs wrote you a thing saying they would never talk to you again, or like they would not give you access anymore and things like that. Like, has that happened?
We don't know yet. I mean, we haven't really made a request, so they haven't had a chance to turn us down. But yeah, I mean, that's the scary part for us. I mean, we're a tiny, tiny, tiny company. The irony is that part of the story, the quotes are about how the league is a single entity. If the owners of Kansas City wanted to, they could probably convince the owners of every other team to blackball us. We are working on a couple projects with other MLS teams. Those are going on fine, but you never know.
Well, it kind of highlights another aspect that I wanted to ask you about, which is just there's sort of like you're writing about these teams or businesses that there's like an access journalism question, like how do you get in there? And then there's also sort of like a fandom question, like to what extent are you guys fans and you're writing as fans of the sport, or to what extent are you trying to do journalism like this, which is actually like digging into it in a deeper.
And we also do projects with MLS and MLS clubs. I mean, we take money from them to work with them and produce stories for them. None that appear in Howler.
Oh, where do those stories go?
With Major League Soccer, we created a digital magazine for them in the 2012 season. 2013 season. We're doing a project now with Portland Timbers that's going to appear on their website throughout the season. We did a print magazine for the LA Galaxy last year that they sent out as part of a season ticket renewal drive.
So they really can't. It's not just they can shut down access to do
more
stories. They can
stop giving us business.
They can shut down money that's coming to you for other things that you're doing.
Yes. And we're always very clear with our readers, like, hey, we're doing this. This is how we stay in business. You know, and there's clearly a conflict of interest, but we're transparent about it. And it's akin to the way that Time Inc. has like a branded content section. And you'll see those those pieces in Fortune or Wired, Tiny Nest and except ours, maybe there's even more removed because these don't appear in Howler, but it's the same people producing the content. So anyway, yeah.
They just changed the ASME just changed their guidelines. Did you see that? The American Society of Magazine Editors, that editors are now allowed to also do branded content.
Look at that. Yeah. We do it as a matter of necessity, but
yeah.
But that's good to know. We're now eligible for awards,
I guess. Yeah, there we go. Let's talk a little bit about like the hustle of like trying to run a new magazine.
What are you talking about? This is really easy.
I mean, you mentioned this like thing that I was involved in some way, which is like this bus trip that we were going to like.
You were our hostage.
Basically, this is a story that I could tell. Howler sponsored a bus trip to go see a U.S. soccer game in Hartford, Connecticut from New York. Mm-hmm. Bunch of people went, including myself and my wife and Josh Dean, who's been on this podcast. Mm-hmm. And then there was crazy traffic. So the bus got stopped in traffic and basically we never made it to the game. And we pulled off in like somewhere in Connecticut.
Fairfield,
Connecticut, and watched it in like an Irish pub that we found. But I think it does epitomize to me, like, first of all, nobody was mad. I feel like you feel really bad about it, but maybe I missed it, but like this is a bus full of people who are just like, all right, that's life.
Well, I think that my outward show of grief over this helped people not to be quite as mad. I think that had something to do with it. I did see one really upset tweet while we were sitting in that bar, and I had already bought pictures for everybody and like gone around and apologized personally to every single person who had gotten off that bus. And I saw one upset tweet, and I went up to the guy and I found him, and I was like, hey, look, I saw this tweet. I know you're upset. Like, let's talk. Like, what can I do to make you happier? And there wasn't really anything, but That was it. It was, people were super, super friendly.
And but it kind of goes back to what we were talking about before, which is like, you are the face in some way. I mean, there are other people too involved, but you're the face in particular this situation of this magazine. So it's not a faceless entity where like you were on the bus. Like it wasn't like you were like back.
It's not like Delta, right? Yeah. If you're delayed on Delta and you get pissed, like the CEO of Delta is not going to come up and personally apologize to you and buy you a beer. That would be awesome.
But you're doing all these things to try to like make it work, whether it's this doing work for the MLS teams or this kind of like, okay, we'll do events. I've seen you online. Like you're doing like Reddit, Ask Me Anything. Like it seems like you're like keeping a lot of balls in the air. And like, does that feel like personally sustainable as a thing to do?
What I'm trying to do is to build like a team that can take on some of these stuff. So I no longer have responsibility for all of our social media, for instance, right? That was exhausting. And, you know, and that's our only marketing. So it was really important. Now we have a great, great, great guy who tweets. He lives in Toronto. I've never met him in person. You know, like a lot of our team. I mean, it's funny, but he's fantastic. And it's such a load off to know that, okay, the voice of Howler is in good hands and this guy can help us promote stuff. And we have a team of web editors who accept submissions and do my apologizing to writers for me and say, look, we haven't monetized the website, so we can't pay for this, but we'll be happy to publish it, you know, and we'll work with you. We have photo editors. We have, Mark and I were editing every piece in the first issue, and that was, took a lot of time and things were late. And so Mark has actually stepped back a little bit. He took a different job and is sort of a lot more busy now and also had a kid and whatever. I've brought on, so we now have an editor who works full-time at Sports Illustrated. We now have an editor who works full-time at Penthouse. We now have an editor who works, you know, at Vanity Fair. And so, you know, I've tried to bring on guys who know how to make a good magazine and are also like soccer. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is it's feeling less and less like, I mean, it still feels like this massively that if I stop pushing the boulder up the hill, it'll just sort of start to roll down and crush everybody in its path, which I think is the feeling that most small business owners have. I mean, I don't know how you feel about the atavist, but if you were to
constantly churn your legs to keep it going, or it's not going to go anywhere.
Yes. And like you're growing and you grow slowly, but like everything, you feel like everything could fall apart the moment you take your eye off it. What I'm trying to do is, you know, and I'm sure you feel the same way, is build something that can run if you have to take a day off, or if you were to go away, or if you know, you want to build like an institution rather than like your thing. The easiest way to do that is by having money and hiring people.
Right.
But we're, you know, there's a whole other sort of economy that we're dealing in, which is interested volunteers / we pay a little bit. But like nowhere near what we would need to get these people full time or really what they deserve in any case. I can't expect anything to come in on time because I really am just grateful that they're giving me any time. You know what I mean? So I can't like be like, hey, you missed a deadline. What, you know, you're gone. You know what I mean?
But it puts you in a tricky spot as an editor because you need to use those hammers to get the magazine out.
Yeah, right. And so it's a constant, like it does feel still like it's like force of personality that has to get things done rather than money. Money is a way to avoid that, but in lieu of that, it's like always being on and always being like, how can I squeeze like every ounce of your talent from you and get you to give me as much time as you can possibly give me? And that's like with everyone I work with, and some people really rise to it and they're amazing, and like I don't know how they don't have full-time jobs doing what they're doing, like what they do for me, because they're great. Sometimes it doesn't work and that's okay, like you learn that. You try to, I've gotten better, I think, at deciding, you know, we get a lot of interest. We get a lot of people just sort of cold calling and saying, hey, how can I be involved? What can I do?
Yeah.
Which is awesome. But I've gotten better at deciding, okay, you're going to be a great addition to this. Like you sort of fit with the people who have been successful with us in the past. I mean, that, I don't know. That sounds really HR-y, which, you know, I don't think of myself in that role at all, but I guess I am in a certain way. We have a team of like 20, 25, 30 people who contribute to Howler. I mean, and I'm not talking about, those aren't freelance writers or illustrators or photographers. Those are people who, you know, we have 5 copy editors, you know, because every piece goes through 3 rounds of copy edits or proofreads. And we have, you know, 2 photo editors. We have like 8 editorial assistants. I mean, I think most places they'd be called interns, but we call them editorial assistants because I hope that helps them on their resumes a little bit. You know, things like that. And it's just this crazy team of people who are everywhere and doing great work, but it's a real project to coordinate it all.
And there's no office, or there is no.
No,
it's just all remote.
Yeah, we're all remote.
Oh, wow. I admit I know nothing about this, but I was reading your Reddit Ask Me Anything from, I don't know when it was, but like three or four people asked about like the people who left Howler who started another soccer magazine, which I had heard of as well, but I haven't, I'm not that familiar with. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I think of them as former business partners.
Yeah.
Obviously. So
they were people you launched it with?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have negative feelings because they tried to close down Howler. And that's not something that we really talked about publicly because there was no reason to. I mean, it could only look bad for us, I guess. And it was a squabble among the founders of this company. And ultimately, I'm really happy with the people we have working on it now. But yeah, I mean, that was a tough time. I learned a lot about the law and business and how to deal with like huge disruptions and, you know, what I felt like was bad faith on the part of business partners, which is a really hard and kind of terrible thing to have to go through. But we made it and I think we're stronger. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm being very vague and you probably have a lot more questions.
No, I mean, well, I don't need to dig into the like personal disputes or really as much as I guess I'm just interested in, you know, this shit is hard enough in a way.
Yeah.
And a thing that I've personally found is that it's very hard not to make everything personal. Like even if just people started another soccer magazine that were you knew and had nothing to do, they hadn't worked with you. Mm-hmm. That's a thing that you could take personally and be sort of like, why did you have to do this? Like we're trying to do this.
It didn't help that it looked exactly like our first two issues, you know, because they were the designers. So.
Oh, they were the designers of the original magazine.
Yeah. So now we have a competitor who looks exactly like us, which is not good. I don't know. Maybe the good argument is that it forces us to sharpen what we do, right? I mean, that's a way to look at it. And I think just in terms of the team, like people working on it, I think we came out way stronger. The root of the problem was that we negotiated like an equity split. When you start a company, you have to divide up equity. And even though it's not worth anything. And ours was very nearly 25, 25, 25, 25. I was the only person who had more, because I quit my job and was doing it full time. But I had just a little bit more. And after two issues, they came to us and said, we want a 50%. And so, and Mark and I had kept over just slightly over 50 because we felt like, okay, if anything happens, we have like that, that's our safety net. And we felt like, you know, we're two issues in, we're doing well, but we're nothing still. We basically said, look, we don't want to renegotiate. We feel like it's pretty fair, to say the least right now. And, that wasn't the answer they wanted. At a certain point, then Mark offered them equity from his own share to get them to 50, and they turned that down. They said it had to come from me. So it got weirdly personal, and I didn't really understand that. I mean, looking back, I can see things a little differently, but I still feel like it was a little bit unnecessary. But I mean, that's my own perspective. I'm sure they would have a different story to tell.
It's crazy how I've been through this myself, like trying to calculate what imaginary money is worth. You know,
well, that's like, the funny. So
it's not worth anything,
right? So they own.
You're trying to tell yourself, like, okay, well, but I don't want to give it up. I don't know. It's like you can get really crazy over it.
The really crazy part was they owned 45% of the magazine, and then when they decided to quit, they then sent us a bill for $310,000, which was, according to them, the market value of the work they had provided for Howler. And we were like, okay, well, look, this is how it works. If you own nearly half of the company, then that's what you get. Like, that's not, you don't then get to bill the company some magical figure of money. Thank God my wife's uncle does this kind of law and sort of took me on pro bono. But it was like the 6-month process of like educating while fighting about how these things go.
Like, was there a point in there where you thought like, fuck it, like, well, go do something else?
No. I mean, there was a point when I thought, oh, well, if this gets really bad, then we may have to shut down Howler, the name Howler and restart it or something. Because when you're arguing over that stuff, you're not actually arguing over money. There was really like very little in the bank account. What you're arguing about is like IP, like the logo and
right.
The list of subscribers and email addresses and things like that, which are intangibles, sort of, right? I mean, there are things that you can redo or change.
Right, you could build up that again
somewhere
else.
Yeah, yeah. But I didn't want to have to do that. I mean, that seemed like a really bad scenario and, like, not good for our readers at all, you know? Like,
you build up that trust and then you have to build it up again.
Yeah, and you have to explain, like, why things are different or why this disruption happened or why we're late now because this thing happened or whatever. You know, it's not good.
So do you have like a personal plan for like, I want to get this thing to this point by this point in my life, or I will go do something else? Or are you like, you can do subsistence magazine making indefinitely?
We've never even had a business plan. Do you guys have a business plan for the Atavist?
We do have a business plan, yes.
Is that helpful?
I mean, it's not like a one document somewhere, but we've always had a general plan for where everything's going, and which is helpful only in the sense that we're like, well, that didn't work, so now we're going to do this.
Yeah. So I guess I have that in my head.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just sort of jumped in, and it's worked so far, which is not great because I feel like I got lucky sometimes. Like, hey, okay, everything's worked. Mostly. Like, you know, there are setbacks, there are problems. But I think my wife would like me to have like a point at which I stop. We launched Howler in summer of 2012. Like a day or two after the Kickstarter campaign ended, my wife and I, she wasn't my wife yet, we moved to California so she could go to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved across the country. We got married a couple months later. And I had quit my job as soon as the Kickstarter thing ended. So those are like kind of stressful. Each of those by itself is kind of a stressful event.
Mm-hmm.
And so altogether it was just kind of a crazy period. She wanted to know like, okay, what is the plan? All I could say is, well, I got to get the next issue out by whatever. And, you know, I think there's a check coming from, you know, this thing and, you know, and so I've been lucky. I've been able to cobble together like a living by, I haven't actually taken a single penny from Howler. I paid taxes on it because that's how that works. But I haven't been paid by Howler. I've been paid by doing other jobs that come to us sort of tangentially. So, you know, if I get a writing gig, you know, to cover soccer, or, you know, we're doing a project for Gatorade right now that's really cool. We're getting more and more of those. And that seems like a way forward for us, like sort of an agency / magazine model where you have, you know, you do client work, but you also make this thing that sort of serves as like your billboard. What we're trying to do now is be more proactive and sort of organized and targeting when we go out and try to get that business rather than like just take whatever comes to us, because that's how it's worked so far. But I don't think a print magazine is ever going to be like the thing that I can just do full time. I mean, I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe it is, but at our subscriber base, it's not. You know, I'd love to double it and then double that. And then if you get to 10,000, then you're like, I think that's like more sustainable. Like that's, you know, because printing costs go up really marginally after a certain point.
Huh.
And so it's really about scale. Like if we can get more readers, then we'll be fine. But at this stage, it's like, okay, we pay for the magazine, but then like, how do I eat?
You know, cobble together your living
exactly
in other ways. Yeah, yeah, so you've been writing for Fusion too.
Yeah, Fusion hired me to launch their World Cup website for the summer. So I went to Miami for 3 months to live there, and like, yeah, so like the hustle, right? That was stressful because my wife is in Memphis, I'm in Miami. By the same token, that allowed us to finally go on a honeymoon like 2 years after 2 years after we got married. So we went to Italy the day after the World Cup.
Oh, lovely. Now I'll tell you the only thing about that bus trip that really bothered me.
Okay.
I've saved it to the end.
I've been waiting. I felt like we needed to have this conversation.
I swear to God, it never bothered me for a second. I thought it was actually great fun because there's something really hilarious about it, about like getting on the bus to go to a soccer game and then like ending up watching in a bar in Connecticut that I would never choose to go to.
I think we should
my
mention
life.
I-95 was insane.
Yeah, it was like a parking lot, basically.
I mean, and people, part of the reason people weren't mad is because they looked out and they were like, okay, this is not George's fault. This is just the world. This is life.
Although the latter part, I feel like there's an unintended consequence of you feeling very apologetic and then you buying everyone beers in the bar and pitchers of beer, which is that some dude behind me on the bus like threw up the way home.
I didn't know about that until we got off the bus.
and that made me think I'm too old to be engaged in this at all, actually. I'm
you know, it's funny. Yeah, but that's not really, when I think of like our reader, I don't know. I was surprised at that. I think there were some shenanigans going on that I was unaware of. And I think free booze, I don't know, how many people were on the bus? Like 60, 45, 60, something like that. One barfer out of 60. I'll take that ratio.
All right, we'll give you that for the sake of the magazine and how important it is to keep this magazine going. All right, well, thanks very much, George. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's Longform Podcast. Thanks to George for coming in. I'm Evan Ratliff, the co-host. Thanks to my other co-hosts, Aaron Lammer and Max Linsky. Thanks always to our editor, Jenna Weiss-Berman, and our intern, Rachel Mabe, and to our sponsors, one of which is Aspiration. Check them out at aspiration.com/longform, and you can sign up there. And we'll see you next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Teen Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Teen Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon, taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.